Okay, we're set.
Okay, welcome everybody to this presentation of the Taxpayer Defense Institute. Happy New Year to all of you that I haven't talked to in the last couple of weeks here. We are going to talk about something that's going to keep us at least relatively busy here over the next 10 or 12 months, and that's the Corporate Transparency Act. This thing kind of came out of nowhere. It was a little known thing that was actually passed in 2021. It was supposed to take effect in 2023, but it didn't. Kind of got pushed under the table at that time, but it is effective now. And we're going to talk about what this is all about. It requires a report to be made to FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, an arm of the Treasury Department. It requires a report of legal entities, quote unquote, entities. And the report has to cover generally two elements of what those legal entities are. It's got to report the beneficial owners, in other words, who owns this entity, and it's got to report who the applicant of the entity was. And we're going to talk about what that looks like. Now, there's three different tiers of effectiveness, right? I said it's effective January 1st. That's true, but it spills into three different areas. And I'm going to detail that later on. As I said, this report is filed with FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, which is an arm of the United States Treasury. And there are civil and criminal penalties, and they're stiff for failing to report. We'll talk about the penalties as the last element of this presentation. So as we move through this, I'm going to talk about the details, and we'll talk about the actual reporting process, and we'll talk about the penalties. It is important to understand, friends, that this reporting requirement is completely separate from the obligation to file a tax return, and it's completely separate from any FBAR requirements. So this has got nothing to do with foreign bank account reporting, and it's got nothing to do with income tax compliance. This is a separate report that is filed separately to FinCEN, not the Internal Revenue Service. We'll talk about that in a little more detail as well. Now, what is the purpose of this? Well, ostensibly, it was passed, they say, to combat money laundering and to deal with tax fraud and to intercept drug traffickers and foreign oligarchs and to quell the funneling of financial aid to terrorists. That's the typical nonsense that we hear from them. In fact, let me read a paragraph to you. This is a short paragraph that comes out of the FinCEN fact sheet on the Corporate Transparency Act. And here's what it says. And this was issued in September of 2023. So this is what this says. It says, recent geopolitical events have reinforced the point that abuse of corporate entities, including shell or front companies by illicit actors and corrupt officials, presents a direct threat to U.S. national security and the U.S. and international financial systems. For example, Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine in February 2022 further underscored that Russian elites, state-owned enterprises, and organized crime, as well as Russian government proxies, have attempted to use U.S. and non-U.S. shell companies to evade sanctions imposed on Russia. This rule will enhance, and the reporting rule is what they're talking about, this rule will enhance U.S. national security by making it more difficult for criminals to exploit opaque legal structures to launder money, traffic humans and drugs, and commit serious tax fraud and other crimes that harm the American taxpayer. So this is the theory behind this reporting. You know, whether you buy that or not, I guess depends on your perspective. As for me, the viewpoint that I look at it, the lens that I look at it from is this: the more and more the United States government thinks it's God. And one of the essential attributes of God is omniscience. Omniscience. God knows everything. Our creator knows everything. If the government's going to be God, it has to know everything. The problem is the government can't just know everything like the creator does. The government has to learn everything. And the only way that it can learn everything is through this ubiquitous reporting requirements that the federal government imposes. Not a year goes by, friends, that there's not another reporting requirement passed by Congress and imposed on American citizens and businesses. Is mostly these reporting requirements, of course, relate to the Internal Revenue Service. But as I said, this one is completely different from the Internal Revenue Service. So simply filing a tax return and reporting income and expenses and, you know, filing the K-1 with the tax return, which reports shareholders and beneficial interest on the K-1, none of that matters. All right. None of that matters. This is a completely different report. So my perspective is that this is just another in a long line of federal statutes designed to create this nonstop river of information flowing into the federal government so they can know everything about everybody at all times. Now, let's get to the details of the Corporate Transparency Act and exactly the mechanics of this thing and how it works. First of all, what companies are required to report? There's a great deal of confusion about who is required to report and exactly what they're required to report. So let's drill into that. A reporting company is defined under the law. Now, the law that we're talking about here is not an Internal Revenue Code section. The law we're talking about here is in Title 31 of the United States Code, which is the financial aspects of the federal government. All right. So Title 31 is what controls this issue, not Title 26, the Internal Revenue Code. All right, a reporting company is defined in that law. I'm going to give you that definition here in just a second. A reporting company is required to report the beneficial ownership information. BOI stands for beneficial ownership information. This is the data that's required to be reported. There are two types of reporting companies. First is a domestic reporting company, and that's a corporation, LLC, or other entity. And here's the key, friends. A reporting company is a company that's created by the filing of a document with the Secretary of State. All right. It's created by the filing of a document with the Secretary of State. We also have a foreign reporting company. So I said there's two types of companies, right? Two types of companies. One is a domestic company. The other is a foreign reporting company. Now, a foreign reporting company is a corporation, LLC, or other legal entity formed under the law of a foreign country that's registered to do business in any state in the United States or within any tribal jurisdiction, again, by filing a document with the Secretary of State. All right, so this includes limited liability partnerships, business trusts, and most limited partnerships. These are entities that are created by the filing of document. And this is the key element of a reporting company. The essential element of a reporting company was an organizational document filed with the Secretary of State. So we're talking about a corporate charter. We're talking about an LLC declaration. We're talking about a certificate of a business trust. Any document required to be, any entity required to be sanctioned by the Secretary of State by filing some organizational document with that Secretary of State is defined as a reporting company. It's domestic reporting company if it's locally based. It's a foreign reporting company if it's a foreign company that's registered to do business in any state or tribal entity. All right, so that's the key. Was the organization created by the filing of a document with a Secretary of State or a similar office? Exclusions. What companies are excluded? Well, right off the bat, sole proprietors. You don't have to file any sort of document with any Secretary of State to be a sole proprietor. Now, in some cases, sole proprietors file an assumed name declaration with their Secretary of State or a DBA notice with the Secretary of State. But that's not a charter. All right, we're talking about that. It's not an organizational document. It's simply a document that's filed that tells the Secretary of State that I'm doing business under this name or that name. All right, the charter is the key. Did you create the entity, the separate legal entity, by filing a charter with the state? That is the key. Most trusts do not file charters with the Secretary of State. Business trusts, on the other hand, do. Under Minnesota law, a business trust is created by the filing of a trust document with the Secretary of State. But a family trust or a trust that's used strictly for estate planning purposes is not filed with the Secretary of State. All right, qualified joint venture enterprises. These are enterprises that exist under the Internal Revenue Code between a husband and a wife. If you've got a husband and wife, mom and pop operation, that files a Schedule C, historically, the Schedule C was filed by the sole proprietor, right? That's the definition of a sole proprietorship, a one-person business, a single individual operating a business. Well, even if the husband and wife are the ones that are doing this, generally speaking, only the husband or maybe only the wife filed the Schedule C and reported the income. And typically, historically, it was the husband. So even though the wife was working with the husband side by side, you know, all of these years, maybe 20, 25 years, she had no Social Security benefits reported under her name because the Schedule C was in the husband's name. Well, over the last, I don't know, maybe 5, 8, 10 years, however long it's been, the IRS allows what's called a qualified joint venture. And this is a situation where you got husband and wife working side by side in a business. Husband and wife then split the income and the expenses equally on two separate Schedule Cs so that both husband and wife get the benefit of Social Security earnings. They do not file any kind of charter or document with the Secretary of State. All right, this is a tax declaration only that is achieved essentially by filing two Schedule Cs. So as Gene stated at the top of the program here, we're going to have polling questions laced through the presentation. And we are up to our first polling question here. I'm going to have three polling questions. You need to answer all three polling questions in one email to gene@taxhelponline.com. Don't send it to the group email. Do not send it to the group email. Send one email to gene@taxhelponline.com and make sure that you answer all three polling questions. Make sure you give us your name and your PTIN so we can get this registered with the Internal Revenue Service. As you all know, Taxpayer Defense Institute is a authorized continuing education provider authorized through the IRS, and we can get this stuff put in here for you now. All right, so I'm going to give you just about 15, 20 seconds to get the answer to that polling question. The first polling question, what is today's date? What is today's date? So let's get that in. And then we will go on from here. Now,
anyone that is on there, you write down the polling questions. You send them to me separately at gene@taxhelponline.com. Do not put them into chat. Thank you.
All right, let's move on here. Let's talk about entities that are exempt from reporting. There is a laundry list of entities that do not have to report. There's actually 23 of them, right? And most of them are financial service industries. I'm not going to go down the whole list of 23 of money service businesses, banks, credit unions, depository institutions, venture capital organizations, investment companies, public utilities, exempt, tax exempt entities. There's 23 of them. Where you get the list, friends, is in this document that FinCEN created called the Small Entity Compliance Guide. Small Entity Compliance Guide. I have the link for the Small Entity Compliance Guide right in your outline. This is the link right here. So copy that down. It'll be in your outline that we distributed. And I strongly recommend you go to that FinCEN site and get this link. The link is, the booklet is very, very helpful. In fact, a lot of the information that I used in my special report for the December 2024 issue of Pillow Talks Taxes came out of that report. So there's a chart in the report. Chart number 2 shows the list of exempt entities. Now you say to yourself, well, why are so many entities exempt? Why are all these financial entities exempt? Why are exempt organizations and insurance companies and state licensed insurance producers? Why are all these people exempt? The answer is they are providing this information on an annual basis through other reports. For example, the Securities and Exchange Commission has a lengthy, like a 45 or 50 page report that gets filed every year by these publicly traded companies. And the financial institutions are the same way. They file these detailed reports with the federal government every single year through other channels. So this would be duplicative in terms of their requirement to report. What FinCEN is looking for with this Corporate Transparency Act is all the small corporations out there that are not publicly traded, that are closely held, that are otherwise not disclosed. Most state records do not require the disclosure. When you start a LLC, for example, does not require disclosure of all the members of the LLC. When you file a corporate charter with the Secretary Secretary of State does not require a disclosure of all the corporate shareholders. So this FinCEN report, this BOI report that we're talking about, is designed to capture all of that information that otherwise would be escaping from the clutches of a government that wants to be omniscient. So that's why we've got the exemptions, and that's what we're talking about. Now, what information has to be reported? Let's get into the specifics here and talk about the information that specifically has to be reported. All right, there's two categories of information that has to be reported. And we talked about the beneficial owners and we talked about the applicants. So now let's talk about the beneficial owner of the company. All right, you got to report the beneficial owner of the company. Who is the beneficial owner? These are the people who directly or indirectly exercise substantial control over the company or own at least 25% of the ownership interest of the company. So now let's talk about these elements here, because these things are defined. All right, so substantial control. What is substantial control? This is very, very broad. In fact, it's the broadest type of definition that you can imagine. Substantial control exists if the individual is a senior officer. All right, a senior officer is a president, a CFO, a CEO, a chief operating officer, or any officer, regardless of title, who performs a similar function to these senior officers. All right, so that'd be number one, a senior officer has substantial control. Number two, a person that has authority to appoint or remove certain officers or a majority of directors. So if you've got an individual in the corporation that individually can remove a senior officer or can remove a majority of the board of directors, that person has substantial control regardless of what their title is. All right, number three is an important decision maker. And this also is very, very broad. What is an important decision maker? This is a person in the company that has unilateral authority or has influence over the important decision making in the company regarding the nature and scope of the business, the attributes of the business, how the business is going to function, where it's going to function, the finances of the business. We're talking about selling or leasing or mortgaging company assets. We're talking about authorizing major expenditures like investments or operating or approving an operating budget or incurring debt on behalf of the corporation. Or we're talking about a person that has substantial authority over substantial control over the structure of the business. Are we going to be a corporation? Are we going to be a partnership? Are we going to be an LLC? Those types of things. And then there's a catch-all, all right? There's a catch-all. Any person that has substantial control in any form, all right? Any other form of substantial control over the reporting company, all right? Control experience, control exercised in new and unique ways can still be substantial. For example, flexible corporate structures may have different indicators of control. All right, so what we're talking about is a very, very broad definition of substantial control of a person that's got the ability and the authority to direct the affairs of the company. Now, what constitutes an ownership interest? All right, okay, this is also very, very broad. And typically, we think of ownership interests in connection with a corporation as stock ownership. And that's true, but that's only part of it. All right. If you've got equity or stock or voting rights in the company, then you have substantial ownership. All right. You've got an ownership interest if that person controls at least 25% of the company. So if you've got a corporation that has five shareholders, with each owning 20% of the company, then you don't have a single individual that has a ownership interest that has to be reported, but one or more of those five individuals has substantial control. So remember, control and ownership interests are two different things. And it's either control or ownership interest. It doesn't have to be both. So you could have a, you could have, as I said, you could have five partners in a five shareholders in a subchapter S corporation, each with 20%. But one of the shareholders, the president, one is the CEO, one is the CFO. Well, those three people, they have to be disclosed on the BOI information because they have substantial control, even though they don't have a substantial ownership interest because they don't control 25% or more of the company. In the small business, the small entity compliance guide, there's a chart in there that I reproduced in the special report. It's chart four that shows the breakdown of what constitutes an ownership interest. And the catch-all is the thing that I want to focus on here. It's, again, it's very, very broad. This catch-all language is very, very broad. And basically what it says is that any other instrument, contract, arrangement, understanding, relationship, or mechanism that's used to establish ownership constitutes an ownership interest, which has to be reported if it's a, if it constitutes at least 25% of the company. So think about that now. It uses the phrase, it uses the word understanding. All right, any instrument, contract, arrangement, understanding, relationship, or mechanism that's used to establish. So you could have a situation where we've got five subchapter S shareholders that have 20%, but there's a handshake agreement that each one of those shareholders is going to give 10% of their interest to a sixth person. Well, 10% of the interest of five people going to six people is 60% to that sixth person, right? So that person would have more than 25% of the, or at least rather 25% of the ownership interest. So this is just as broad as it can possibly be when it comes to reporting the ownership interest in one of these entities. All right, now let's talk about exceptions to beneficial ownership reporting. There is now I'm not talking about the exemptions for companies. Now I'm talking about for beneficial owners. Earlier, I talked about the 23 entities that are exempt from filing the BOI report itself. All right. What I'm talking about here now are exceptions to reporting individuals as beneficial owners. There's five categories of exemptions for reporting individuals as beneficial owners. All right. And the first one is a minor child. All right. Minor child. And a minor child is defined under the law of the state or Indian tribe in which the domestic company or the foreign company is, where the domestic company is created or the foreign company is registered. However, there's a proviso here, provided that the company reports the required information for the parent or guardian of the minor child. So you don't have to report the child, but you got to report the child's parent or guardian. The second category, an individual acting as a nominee, intermediary, custodian, or agent on behalf of another individual, an employee of a reporting company acting solely as an employee whose substantial control or economic benefits are derived solely from employment status of the company, provided that such person is not a senior officer. Remember, senior officers have substantial control by definition. They need to be reported. And the fourth one, D on your list there, an individual who's only interested in a reporting company is a future interest through a right of inheritance. We don't need to report that. And then a creditor of a reporting company does not need to be reported. Okay, so that brings us up to our next polling question. Our next polling question is, what is the subject of this presentation? What is the subject of this presentation? Remember, we need answers to all three polling questions. We're going to have three polling questions. We need answers to all three polling questions in one email to Gene@taxhelponline.com. Don't put it in the chat. Don't send it to the group. Send it to Gene@taxhelponline.com. All three polling questions with your name, with your full name and your P10, so that we can get you your credit when this presentation is completed. Okay, now I'm going to give you about 15 seconds to get that done. The subject of the presentation, obviously, is the Corporate Transparency Act. Corporate Transparency Act. Okay, let's move on here. Who is the company applicant? Remember, we're reporting owners of the company and we're reporting who the applicants are. A company applicant is only one of three persons. Only one of three people is a company applicant. When we're talking about a domestic company, it's the individual who directly files the document with the Secretary of State that creates the entity. All right. The individual that directly files the document. For a foreign company, it's the person who files the document that registers the entity to do business in the United States. For either type of company, it's the individual who is primarily responsible for directing or controlling the filing if more than one person is involved. All right, so who is the ultimate authority behind the company getting registered? That is the person that has to file, that has to be reported on the BOI as the company applicant. Now, there's a proviso here with respect to this as well. All right, not all company applicants have to be disclosed. All right, if the company existed or was registered before January 1st, 2024, in other words, it already existed as of January 1st, 2024, those companies do not need to identify or report the company applicant. It's only companies that are formed on or after January 1st, 2024 that need to disclose the company applicant. All right, for companies that are existing on or before that are existing before January 1st, 2021, they're reporting their substantial ownership information, all right, the ownership and control, but they're not reporting the applicant. All right, now filing the reports. Let's talk about actually filing the reports. As I said already, the reports are filed with FinCEN. They are not filed with the Internal Revenue Service. This is not a federal tax form. This is not a form that goes with your tax return. It's not in any way, shape, or form connected to tax compliance. All right. It has to go to the FinCEN group through their website. We'll talk about that. The effective date. Now I said earlier that there are three tiers of effective dates here. All right, three tiers. So let's break down the three tiers because it's you know, it can't be simple, of course. So first tier, companies created or registered before January 1st, 2024. They have 1 year to file the report. My guess is that everybody on this call has to file a report, but because your businesses were very likely, your entities were very likely in existence before January 1st, you have 1 year to submit this FinCEN report, this BOI report. Companies registered before January 1st, 2024 have 1 year to report. The due date is January 1st, 2025. Companies created or registered on or after January 1st, and before January 1st, 2025. So companies that are created during 2024, this 12-month window starting January 1st, ending December 31st, those companies have 90 days to report. All right. You've got, if so, for any client of yours that creates a new entity this year, you have to be cognizant of this reporting requirement and you got to notify these people of the reporting requirements. So it's so if they start an LLC, if they start a corporation, that they turn into an S corporation, if they've got a limited liability partnership, any of these entities, again, created by the filing of a document with the Secretary of State, they need to be on notice that they've got 90 days to file that report. All right, now let's talk about companies created on or after January 1st, company of 2025. So companies created after January 1st, 2025, they've got 30 days to report. So we're ratcheting down the time period for filing this report. Companies in existence before January 1st of 2024 have the entire year to report. Companies created during 2024 have 90 days to report. Companies created after January 1st, 2024, 2025 rather, have 30 days to report. So that's the breakdown. Now, what about when does this time period start to run? All right, the 30 or 90 day periods that I described here start to run after you get the notice from the Secretary of State that your entity has been created, right? That's the trip date. It's not the filing of a tax return. It's not, there's only one trip date, and that's the receipt of the notice of creation from the Secretary of State, creation or registration, whatever the case may be. Now, let's talk about correcting reports. Let's talk about correcting reports here, because there is a specific provision in the law for correcting or amending reports, right? So if you submitted a report that was erroneous, or you need to amend a report because your ownership interests or substantial control individuals have changed for whatever reason, you've got 30 days to report the changes. All right, so you got 30 days to report the changes in amending a report. And if you have knowledge, or the entity, the individuals controlling the entity have knowledge of or have reason to know that a prior report is inaccurate, it has to be corrected within 30 days. Must be corrected within 30 days. Now, how do we file the reports? I alluded to this earlier. They're not filed with tax returns. You don't file them with the IRS. They must be filed electronically with FinCEN. All right, so this is an online report, and they've got an online portal that was set up and was operational as of January 1st, 2024. So it's been 2 weeks now that this thing has been up and running. I have to tell you that I have not tried it yet, although I've got to file the reports. As I said already, I'm sure just about everybody on this call, if not everybody on this call, has to file such a report. I have not tested the FinCEN report as yet. I understand from what I've read is that this is pretty easy to do as far as the actual mechanics of filing the report. So we've got I've got the web address right there for you in the outline, FinCEN.gov/BOI. So you can go on the report, go on the website, and then you set up your portal, and then you go ahead and you submit the report. All right, next polling question, third and final polling question. Who is today's presenter? That would be me. Remember, we need answers to all three polling questions. We need the answers in one email addressed to gene@taxhelponline.com. And make sure you include your name, make sure you include your PTIN so we can get you the credit you need for this presentation. All right, now penalties. Let's talk about the penalties. As I said before, the penalties are stiff. They're very, very significant. All right, these penalties are under Title 31 U.S. Code Section 5336. All right, they're both civil and criminal penalties. And the statute makes it unlawful to provide a false or fraudulent BOI report. The statute makes it unlawful for any person required to file the report to willfully fail to file the required report. So we got civil and criminal penalties both. So let's talk about what those penalties are. The civil penalties, there is a civil fine, get this, friends, of up to $500 a day for each day that a failure to file continues. So this is obviously quite serious. The criminal penalties, obviously serious. $10,000 fine and imprisonment up to 2 years or both for willful failure to file. Of course, in a criminal case, the government has to prove willfulness beyond a reasonable doubt. So that's going to be, could be a challenge. But you know, more and more and more, we're seeing these egregious penalties for failure to provide the information to the government that they're looking for. Now, as I said earlier, I did a special report in the December 2024 issue of the newsletter. I want to remind you to carefully read that special report. It's a detailed analysis of the things that we've gone through here today. In the special report, I have copies of a number of the charts from the from the from FinCEN small business or small entity compliance guide. It's not a small business compliance guide, it's a small entity compliance guide. And the reason it's not small business and it's small entity is because small businesses have not necessarily created an entity by filing a document with the Secretary of State. This is the key to this whole thing. This is the question I've been asked 20 times already in January, and it's only January 17th. Do I have to file this BOI report? And the answer is, did you create an entity by filing something with the Secretary of State besides an assumed name declaration? An assumed name declaration did not create an entity. Now, at least that's the case in Minnesota. Now, you got to look at your own state's rules and see what the requirements are in your own state, what the rules might be in your own state. But that's what the key element is the creation of an entity by filing a document with the Secretary of State. That's the key. So go through that special report, look at the charts that I have there, and then consult the small entity compliance guide that was created by the created by FinCEN, which is very helpful. So now, what we're going to do now is go to questions. So, Gene, do we have some questions? I see something in the chat here. What about 10% for the big guy, Charles Markham? well, that would be a question as to whether he has substantial control. He might not. He doesn't have the 25% ownership, but does he have substantial control? Look at the catch-all. All right, an individual has substantial control if there's any other instrument, contract, agreement, understanding, relationship, or mechanism that's used to establish ownership. I would suggest to you that there's an understanding and a relationship that would require the reporting of the big guy in connection with his son's operations. But what do I know? All right, so next question from James Taylor. Does the sole proprietorship exclusion include single member LLCs? No, it does not, because a single member LLC is still an LLC created by the filing of a document with the Secretary of State. That's where this whole thing hinges, is on the filing of a document. Most LLCs are single members. Most LLCs are, they're single members. They still have to file this report. All right, so sole proprietorships don't have to file the report, and trusts created for estate planning purposes don't have to file the report. But if you've created a business trust under the rules of your state and filed a document with the Secretary of State to create a business trust, and you operate as a business trust, that would require the filing of the report. All right, so Charles answered that question correctly, so that's good. Okay, so then James Taylor says, all right, Dan, will Dan take questions at the end? Yes, I will. All right, would mere signing authority on a company checking account amount to control? Well, it depends. If that signing authority is unilateral, then or not even necessarily unilateral, but is exercised in connection with other elements of substantial control, then you would have to report it. But if your signing authority on the bank account is simply clerical and you can only act under the direction of other officers, then it would not have to be reported. The catch-all for substantial control is a form of substantial control that is existed that well, here, let's just look at it here. Do you control the nature of the business in terms of the attributes of the business, the scope of the business, and how it functions? Do you control the selection or termination of business lines of credit or ventures, or geographical locations of the business operation? Do you control the finances of the business? All right, so this is where the signer would come into play. Do you have authority to control business sales, leases, mortgages, other transfers of assets? All right, do you have do you control major expenditures or investments or insurance purchases or equity or any of those other types of elements of the business? Do you can all right, so simply signing as a clerk in a clerical function on a checking account for the business, I do not believe creates substantial control over the business. You got to be a decision maker. All right. In this sense, I would refer to the law with respect to the trust fund recovery penalty. The trust fund recovery penalty cases have made it perfectly clear that merely signing on a business checking account in a clerical function, in other words, doing the bidding for those who do control the business, does not create any liability for the trust fund recovery penalty. And I have to believe those same rules of law would apply here. You have to be able to control the final decision-making elements of the business, which simply signing on a checking account as in a clerical faction in a clerical fashion. Would not create. Next question is, how much should we charge to prepare these reports? Well, I've looked at the information. It does not appear to me that the information is any more voluminous than would show up on an FBAR report or would show up on the IRS report of foreign financial assets that gets filed with your tax return. I forget what that form number is. It's 88 something. Maybe Chris Churchwell knows off the top of his head what that form is that's put with the tax return if you've got more than $50,000 of assets in held in a foreign company. The FBAR report is for $10,000 of assets. The IRS form is for $50,000 of assets, and it's 88 something. And I don't remember what it is. But as I said, I don't believe that there is that the information on this BOI report is any more voluminous than what's on the FBAR report. So my question is, what would you be charging to prepare an FBAR report? What would you be charging to prepare that additional tax form that goes with the 1040 form? Take a look at what's required, the information that's required. In my special report, friends, that I produced in December, I have a checklist in there of the information that's required on this BOI report. And that I'm looking through it right now to find where the checklist, there it is right here. It's on page 7. Page 7 of my report is a checklist of the information that goes on this BOI report. So look at that checklist. Ask yourself, how long is it going to take me to gather that information from the client? Look at the form itself on the FinCEN website. How long is it going to take me to prepare the form? I can't imagine it's an hour's worth of work total. So, you know, that would be your guide in terms of deciding how much to charge for this thing. All right. Do charitable, Eric asks, do charitable entities have to report? Tax-exempt entities do not have to report. They are one of the 23 exempt entities because they are reporting on their Form 990 anyway. Well, first of all, tax-exempt entities don't have owners. Right? You can't have shareholders in the traditional sense on a tax-exempt entity. So they're not, so they don't have any ownership information. They have a board of directors who controls the organization, but they don't have anybody who owns it. They have employees that get paid fair market value for their services. That's true, but they don't have ownership information. But in any event, exempt organizations, a tax-exempt entity does not have to report. Okay, so does the sole proprietorship exclusion, what am I looking at here? Does the sole proprietorship exclusion include single member LLCs? No, it does not, because remember, an LLC is created, well, we already answered that one, is created by the filing of a doc. I already answered that question. And Charles Markham did too. What liabilities go with the preparer of a BOI report? Well, I would say there are no specific liabilities that I saw in the statute for the BOI report, but I got to believe that the same rules of due diligence that are going to apply to a tax return are going to be made to apply to this thing if you prepare the report for us, if you prepare the report for clients. So that would be my answer. You know, that would be my answer, but that would be my answer. So the next question is, when does this report? Great, Grant Cooper, I'm not finding, I'm not following this. But when do we do this? When do we do this report? A lot of potential liability. But when we do this report, I'm not following this. I think you're asking me, is there a lot of liability for doing this report? I don't think there's any more liability doing this report than there is doing a tax return or doing an FBAR report. You gather the information, you have the client certify to you that the information is correct. You take the information from the client that they reported to you and that they certified was correct. You prepare the document based on their information that they certified was correct. And as long as you did your due diligence, you know, what more liability can there be? So that's my answer there. All right. So do we have any other questions or anything else? If you got a question, you can put it in the chat. I didn't see anything, Ray, frequency of filing. One and done. Yes. The question is one and done unless there's a change of information. One and done unless there's a change of information. If the information changes because ownership or control changes, then you need to amend the report. And you've got 30 days to amend the report. Is that what I said here? I'm sure it's 30 days. Yeah, you got 30 days to amend the report or 30 days to correct it if you have reason to know that it's wrong or inaccurate. So that would be the issue, is one and done, then plus amending it as circumstances change. So that's the frequency issue. Good question on that. Yes. All right. So do we have any other questions, comments, observations here? Notes, if you want to speak. Chris Churchwell, can you answer my question? Do you know off the top of your head what the tax form number is that has to be put with the tax return for reporting foreign financial assets apart from the FBAR? It's 88 something, and I forget what the rest of the numbers are.
Me too.
All right. Can anybody else help us with that form?
Sorry about that one.
Maybe somebody go to the Google machine quick and see if you can find it. All right. Any other questions or comments? Anything else? Gene, do we see any hands up?
I do not see anything more. You've been answering the questions, so I think we're good.
I can answer the form number. It's 8938.
8938. There we go. Thanks,
it's
Patty.
The, 8938. The statement, yeah. The statement of foreign financial assets that you include with your 1040.
Right. Do you have the form right in front of you there, Patty, by any chance?
I do. I actually... yeah, I'll click it open. Yeah.
Wait, okay. So,
yes, I do. Were you looking for something?
So tell me, based on your quick view of the form, how voluminous is the information that you have to provide?
Well, I've done these in the past, and you know, you have to actually make sure you get they're looking for the number of deposit accounts, the maximum value of all the deposit accounts, number of custodial accounts, maximum value of all the custodial accounts, were any foreign deposit or custodial accounts closed during the tax year. Just part one alone, called foreign deposit and custodial account summary, requires you to obtain literally what I've obtained in the past are these statements, the statements
yes.
of their bank statements, custodial account statements. You get the actual, you know, statements from the foreign, investment company or bank or pension, etc.
Yeah,
then after that.
Answer. So you as preparer have to pour through those statements to make sure you get the data correct. And that's not required on this BOI report at all. So you'd spend substantially more time on this financial reporting than you will on the BOI form.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Patty,
what we're talking about here today. Yeah.
So Patty, my question to you is what do you charge to prepare that form? What'd you say,
8938.
So what do you typically charge to prepare that?
I mean, if I know I'm going to have to include one in a 1040, and of course I know I'm going to be needing all this information, and then what I have to pick off of that and then enter it in here, because I've also even had land, you know, foreign, because this is all about foreign assets. So I've identified description of other assets other than custodial and bank accounts. There's been land and property and things like that. You know, you have to look at the complexity. You have to look at what's at risk for you not getting everything, because you're trusting in your client to turn around and actually go back to this foreign entity and get all these statements for you. And it may lead, that's the other thing. And going through this, it made the form itself, the 8939, it looking at this information may end up leading you to other forms,
sure,
like the 3520, 8621, 3528. You have to look at all those other potential specified foreign financial assets. So comparing that to the BOI form, I mean, I think I just saw Chris say in the chat he charged like $250 to do a BOI. At least, yeah, that.
I think that's more of a suggestion.
At least that, to do a BOI.
How does that sound to you, Patty?
$250? I'm sorry, but my hourly rate is even more than $250. So, and so I think I have to go a little higher. It's also the fact that if you're doing this for your clients versus that, you know, it's not like you're going to market for this. You're not going to put it out there and say, hey, I do these BOIs. Well, then maybe you will, though. That is an additional income source, I guess. If I look at doing it for my clients, I don't know, you know, yeah. You know, I do $250. I wouldn't charge them, because I'm charging them for the other services I'm doing. And this is just, sometimes I might even turn around and throw this in knowing, sure, my clients. Like if you know your clients are going to do it for, and you just know how you're going to fill this out, I probably would throw that in. Chris has a large firm. I'm sorry, what'd you say, Dan?
I said one thing I would suggest is that you send out a client letter to all of your yeah, clients that you know are doing business through an entity, yeah, and you know that because you're preparing their, yeah, tax returns, to put them on notice that they have to file, yeah, this thing, and maybe invite them to say, you know, you can do it yourself or we can do it for you, but you know, this has got to be done this year, but it's got to be done within the next 11 and a half months now.
Yeah, I definitely was going to do that as I was talking to my clients and any new tax cases. Yeah, Chris says that's what his firm's doing. Mm-hmm. As you're talking to these clients, because it's tax season, as you're taking on new cases or you're in the middle of doing client defense and resolution cases, yeah, you bring it up for sure then, no doubt. Chris, are you sending out, did you say you're sending out notices to your clients? Is it going in out with your organizers or anything like that?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
We're doing it in our client, yeah, letter. Yeah. We're explaining it and then just offering to help them for, yep, $250 for each LLC.
Yeah, because you got to do a separate one for each entity. So if you got a client with multiple LLCs, like a lot of these real estate people have, yeah, you need one for each entity. Okay, so yeah, Eric, you ask, yeah, how would you compute 8838? I think you mean 8938 value for software in development. What do you mean by that? You can unmute yourself and talk, Eric, if you would. Eric?
I got it. Okay. I have a client that's joined with some people in Italy and Great Britain and developing software for other companies similar to NVIDIA. They're just starting to finish up on the software development, and it could be, you know, worth the contracts, probably several hundred thousand to maybe more than a million. I was just wondering how I go about, you know, valuing that, because they probably have to start filing the 8938 this year.
I'm not
it's
sure.
It's basically valuing an intangible asset.
Well, we're not putting any values on this BOI form. There's only ownership interest that's disclosed. We're not valuing their shares of any kind. It's the 80. Mm-hmm. It's the 8938 that puts values on it.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah, it's just kind of curious.
Yeah. So, you know, you're going to have to value that based on the fair market value of the asset somehow. I don't know how you do that. That's beyond the scope of this discussion. I mean, I'm happy to talk to you about that separately, but that would be an issue for fair market value.
Okay. My mother always told me to ask.
Say again?
My mother always told me to ask.
Well, that's right. Okay, so Charles, you put up here that there's a company out there that's doing this. Can you talk about what that is? Can you unmute yourself and talk about what you know about that?
Yeah, I don't have a relationship with these people, but there's a company called fileforms.io. I'm sure there are going to be others. But they've really made it a business project of theirs to and accountants in particular. You can offload it to this company. One of the neat features they have is, let's say you have an S corporation with five different owners, like I happen to have. You can say to this company here, go to these guys and deal with this. And they have it set up that the five different, you tell them about the five different owners and their emails, and they will start bugging each and every owner. You've got to log on. You've got to enter your information. You've got to upload a copy of your driver's license. And then when it's all pulled together, they will file the form. They will also track when a driver's license expires and will send out an info. Hey, your driver's license expired. You need to log in and enter in the new information. And so I think, and the other thing I want to add is that I'm involved in a lot of the accountant circles and the National Association, the tax professionals, and there's a lot going on. Do EAs and CPAs even want to be doing this? Apparently, if you call up your Arizona emissions carrier and you say, hey, am I covered by this? Most of them will say a resounding no, you're not. They view it more like a legal thing. So a lot of us, I, for example, have never worried about whether or not my clients are filing their annual reports with the Secretary of State. That's their business as far as I'm concerned. I realize other accountants would view this differently, but I don't get involved in that. You just got to deal with that. And I'm telling everybody about this, but I'm also telling them this is something they get to do, but that's me. I mean, we all do this differently, I think the third-party services are something to look into.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good point. All right. That's a good point. Anything else? I don't see anything else in the chat. Gene, do you see anybody with their hand up or anything?
I do not see anyone else.
Okay. Well, if there's no more questions, I want to thank everybody for your participation and your time. And I want you to watch your emails carefully as we go forward here, because it's going to be relatively short order. I don't know, maybe 6-8 weeks or so by the time we nail down the date and place for the 2024 defense conference. So you're going to want to get that on your schedule as soon as you possibly can, as soon as we know about it. So watch your emails, and I appreciate your time and attention, and I appreciate everybody's participation.